secrecy. She was to tell no one, which dampened the fun quite a bit, but added to the mystery. She did reveal the secret to friends, of course, but only after first securing their oaths that they absolutely would tell no one else. To Emmeline, Holmes's claim of lordly heritage had credibility. The name Holmes clearly was English. To know that, all one had to do was read the immensely popular stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And an English heritage would explain his extraordinary charm and smooth manner, so unusual in brutish, clangorous Chicago. Emmeline was a warm and outgoing woman. She wrote often to her family in Lafayette, Indiana, and to the friends she had made in Dwight. She acquired friends easily. She still dined at regular intervals with the woman who ran the first boarding house in which she had stayed after her arrival in Chicago, and considered the woman an intimate friend. In October, two of her second cousins, Dr. and Mrs. B.J. Sigrend, paid her a visit. Dr. Sigrend, a dentist with an office at North and Milwaukee Avenues on Chicago's north side, had contacted Emmeline because he was working on a history of the Sigrend family. They had not previously met. "I was charmed by her pleasing manners and keen wit," Dr. Sigrend said. "She was a splendid woman physically, being tall, well-formed, and with a wealth of flaxen hair." Dr. Sigrend and his wife did not encounter Holmes on this visit, and in fact they never did meet him face to face. But they heard glowing stories from Emmeline about his charm, generosity, and business prowess. Emmeline took her cousins on a tour of Holmes's building and told them of his effort to transform it into a hotel for exposition guests. She explained, too, how the elevated railroad being erected over 63rd Street would carry guests directly to Jackson Park. No one doubted that by the summer of 1893, armies of visitors would be advancing on Englewood. To Emmeline, success seemed inevitable. Emmeline's enthusiasm was part of her charm. She was headlong in love with her young physician, and thus in love with all that he did. But Dr. Sigrend did not share her glowing assessment of the building and its prospects. To him, the building was gloomy and imposing, out of spirit with its surrounding structures. Every other building of substance in Englewood seemed to be charged with the energy of anticipation, not just of the World's Fair, but of a grand future expanding far beyond the fair's end. Within just a couple of blocks of 63rd rose huge, elaborate houses of many colors and textures, and down the street stood the Timmerman Opera House and the adjacent New Julian Hotel, whose owners clearly had spent heavily on fine materials and expert craftsmen. In contrast, Holmes's building was dead space, like the corner of a room where the gaslight could not reach. Clearly, Holmes had not consulted an architect, at least not a competent one. The building's corridors were dark and pocked with too many doors. The lumber was low grade, the carpentry slipshod. Passages veered at odd angles. Still, Emmeline seemed entranced. Dr. Sigrend would have been a cold man indeed to have dashed that sweet, naive adoration. Later, no doubt, he wished he had been more candid and had listened more closely to the whisper in his head about the wrongness of that building and the discontinuity between its true appearance and Emmeline's perception of its appearance. But again, Emmeline was in love. It was not his place to wound her. She was young and enraptured, her joy infectious, especially to Dr. Sigrend, the dentist, who saw so little joy from day to day as he reduced grown men of proven courage to tears. Soon after the Sigrend's visit, Holmes asked Emmeline to marry him, and she accepted. He promised her a honeymoon in Europe, during which, of course, they would pay a visit to his father, the Lord. Monstrosity. Olmsted's teeth hurt. His ears roared, and he could not sleep. Yet throughout the first months of 1892, he kept up a pace that would have been punishing for a man one-third his age. He traveled to Chicago, Asheville, Knoxville, Louisville, and Rochester, each overnight leg compounding his distress. In Chicago, despite the tireless efforts of his young lieutenant, Harry Codman, the work was far behind schedule, the task ahead growing more enormous by the day. The first major deadline, the dedication set for October 21st, 1892, seemed impossibly near, and would have seemed even more so had not fair officials changed the original date, October 12th, to allow New York City to hold its own Columbus celebration. Given the calumny New York previously had shoveled on Chicago, the postponement was an act of surprising grace. Construction delays elsewhere on the grounds were especially frustrating for Olmsted. When contractors fell behind, his own work fell behind. His completed work also suffered. Workmen trampled his plantings and destroyed his roads. The government building was a case in point. All over its surroundings, reported Rudolf Ulrich, his landscape superintendent, material of any kind and all descriptions was piled up and scattered in such profusion that only repeated and persistent pressure brought to bear upon the officials in charge could gain any headway in beginning the work, and even then, improvements being well underway, no regard was paid to them. What had been accomplished one day would be spoiled the next. The delays and damage angered Olmsted, but other matters distressed him even more. Unbelievably, despite Olmsted's hectoring, Burnham still seemed to consider steam-powered launches an acceptable choice for the exposition's boat service. And no one seemed to share his conviction that the wooded island must remain free of all structures. The island had come under repeated assault, prompting a resurfacing of Olmsted's old anger about the compulsion of clients to tinker with his landscapes. Everyone wanted space on the island. First, it was Theodore Thomas, conductor of Chicago's symphony, who saw the island as the ideal site, the only site, for a music hall worthy of the fair. Olmsted would not allow it. Next came Theodore Roosevelt, head of the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and a human gunboat. The island, he insisted, was perfect for the hunting camp exhibit of his Boone and Crockett Club. Not surprisingly, given Roosevelt's power in Washington, the politicians of the fair's National Commission strongly endorsed his plan. Burnham, partly to keep the peace, also urged Olmsted to accept it. "Would you object to its being placed on the north end of the island, snuggled in among the trees, purely as an exhibit, provided it shall be so concealed as to only be noticed casually by those on the island, and not at all from the shore?" Olmsted did object. He agreed to let Roosevelt place his camp on a lesser island, but would not allow any buildings, only a few tents, some horses, campfire, etc. Later, he permitted the installation of a small hunter's cabin. Next came the U.S. government, seeking to place an Indian exhibit on the island. And after this, Professor Putnam, the fair's chief of ethnology, who saw the island as the ideal site for several exotic villages. The government of Japan also wanted the island. They propose an outdoor exhibit of their temples, and, as has been usual, they desire space on the wooded island, Burnham wrote in February 1892. To Burnham it now seemed inevitable that something would occupy the island. The setting was just too appealing. Burnham urged Olmsted to accept Japan's proposal. "It seems beyond any question to be the thing fitting to the locality, and I cannot see that it will in any manner detract essentially from the features which you care for. They propose to do the most exquisitely beautiful things, and desire to leave the buildings as a gift to the city of Chicago after the close of the fair." Fearing much worse, Olmsted agreed. It did not help his mood any that as he battled to protect the island, he learned of another attack on his beloved Central Park. At the instigation of a small group of wealthy New Yorkers, the state legislature had quietly passed a law authorizing the construction of a speedway on the west side of the park so that the rich could race their carriages. The public responded with outrage. Olmsted weighed in with a letter describing the proposed road as unreasonable, unjust, and immoral. The legislature backed off. His insomnia and pain, the crushing workload, his mounting frustration, all tore at his spirit until by the end of March he felt himself on the verge of physical and emotional collapse. The intermittent depression that had shadowed him throughout his adult life was about to envelop him once again. "When Olmsted is blue," a friend once wrote, "the logic of his despondency is crushing and terrible." Olmsted, however, believed all he needed was a good rest. In keeping with the therapeutic mores of the age, he decided to do his convalescing in Europe, where the scenery also would provide an opportunity to enrich his visual vocabulary. He planned forays to public gardens and parks and the grounds of the old Paris Exposition. He put his eldest son, John, in charge of the Brookline office and left Harry Codman in Chicago to guide the work on the World's Fair. At the last minute, he decided to bring along two of his children, Marion and Rick, and another young man, Phil Codman, who was Harry's younger brother. For Marion and the boys, it promised to be a dream journey. For Olmsted, it became something rather more dark. They sailed on Saturday, April 2nd, 1892, and arrived in Liverpool under a barrage of hail and snow. In Chicago, Saul Bloom received a cable from France that startled him. He read it a couple of times to make sure it said what he thought it said. His Algerians, scores of them, along with all their animals and material possessions, were already at sea, sailing for America and the fair, 1 year early. They had picked the right month, Bloom said, but the wrong year. Olmsted found the English countryside charming, the weather bleak and morbid. After a brief stay at the home of relatives in Chislehurst, he and the boys left for Paris. Daughter Marion stayed behind. In Paris, Olmsted went to the old exposition grounds. The gardens were sparse, suppressed by a long winter, and the buildings had not weathered well, but enough of the fair remained to give him a tolerable idea of what the exposition once had been. Clearly the site was still popular. During one Sunday visit, Olmsted and the boys found four bands playing, refreshment stands open, and a few thousand people roaming the paths. A long line had formed at the base of the Eiffel Tower. With the Chicago Fair always in mind, Olmsted examined every detail. The lawns were rather poor, the gravel walks not pleasant to the eye nor to the foot. He found the Paris Fair's extensive use of formal flowerbeds objectionable. "It seemed to me," he wrote in a letter to John in Brookline, "that at the least it must have been extremely disquieting, gaudy and childish, if not savage and an injury to the exposition, through its disturbance of dignity and injury to breadth, unity, and composure." He reiterated his insistence that in Chicago, simplicity and reserve will be practiced and petty effects and frippery avoided. The visit rekindled his concern that in the quest to surpass the Paris Exposition, Burnham and his architects had lost sight of what a World's Fair ought to be. "The Paris buildings," Olmsted wrote, "have much more color and much more ornament in color, but much less in molding and sculpture than I had supposed. They show, I think, more fitness for their purposes, seem more designed for the occasion, and to be less like grand permanent architectural monuments than ours are to be. I question if ours are not at fault in this respect, and if they are not going to look too assuming of architectural stateliness, and to be over-bonded with sculptural and other efforts for grandeur and grandiloquent pomp." Olmsted liked traveling with his youthful entourage. In a letter to his wife in Brookline, he wrote, "I am having a great deal of enjoyment, and I hope laying in a good stock of better health." Soon after the party returned to Chislehurst, however, Olmsted's health degraded, and insomnia again shattered his nights. He wrote to Harry Codman, who was himself ill with a strange abdominal illness, "I can only conclude now that I am older and more used up than I had supposed." A doctor, Henry Rayner, paid a social visit to Chislehurst to meet Olmsted. He happened to be a specialist in treating nervous disorders, and was so appalled by Olmsted's appearance that he offered to take him to his own house in Hampstead Heath outside London and care for him personally. Olmsted accepted. Despite Rayner's close attention, Olmsted's condition did not improve. His stay at Hampstead Heath became wearisome. "You know that I am practically in prison here," he wrote to Harry Codman on June 16, 1892. "Every day I look for decided improvement, and thus far every day I am disappointed." Dr. Rayner, too, was perplexed, according to Olmsted. He says, with confidence, "After repeated examinations of all my anatomy, that I have no organic trouble, and that I may reasonably expect, under favorable circumstances, to keep at work for several years to come. He regards my present trouble as a variation in form of the troubles which led me to come abroad." Most days Olmsted was driven by carriage through the countryside, every day more or less on a different road, to view gardens, churchyards, private parks, and the natural landscape. Nearly every ornamental flower bed offended him. He dismissed them as childish, vulgar, flaunting, or impertinent, out of place and discordant. The countryside itself, however, charmed him. "There is nothing in America to be compared with the pastoral or with the picturesque beauty that is common property in England. I cannot go out without being delighted. The view before me as I write, veiled by the rain, is just enchanting." The loveliest scenes he found were comprised of the simplest, most natural juxtapositions of native plants. "The finest combination is one of gorse, sweetbriar, brambles, hawthorn, and ivy. Even when there is no bloom, this is charming. And these things can be had by the 100,000 at very low prices." At times, the scenes he saw challenged his vision of Jackson Park. At other times, they affirmed it. "Everywhere the best ornamental grounds that we see are those in which vines and creepers are outwitting the gardener. We can't have little vines and weeds enough." He knew there was too little time to let nature alone produce such effects. "Let us, as much as possible, train out creepers and branches of trees upon bridges, pulling down and nailing the branches, aiming to obtain shade and reflection of foliage and broken obscuration of water." Above all, his sorties reinforced his belief that the wooded island, despite the Japanese temple, should be made as wild as possible. "I think more than ever of the value of the island," he wrote to Harry Codman, "and of the importance of using all possible original means of securing impervious screening, dense, massive piles of foliage on its borders, with abundant variety of small detail in abject subordination to general effect. There cannot be enough of bulrush, adlumia, Madeira vine, catbriar, virgin's bower, brambles, sweet peas, jimson weed, milkweed, the smaller western sunflowers, and morning glories." But he also recognized that the wildness he sought would have to be tempered with excellent groundskeeping. He worried that Chicago would not be up to the task. "The standard of an English laborer, hack driver, or cad in respect to neatness, smugness, and elegance of gardens and grounds and paths and ways is infinitely higher than that of a Chicago merchant prince or virtuoso," he wrote to Codman, "and we shall be disgraced if we fail to work up to a far higher level than our masters will be prepared to think suitable." Overall, Olmsted remained confident that his exposition landscape would succeed. A new worry troubled him, however. "The only cloud I see over the exposition now is the cholera," he wrote in a letter to his Brookline office. "The accounts from Russia and from Paris this morning are alarming." As Saul Bloom's Algerians neared New York Harbor, workers assigned to the Midway erected temporary buildings to house them. Bloom went to New York to meet the ship and reserved 2 train cars to bring the villagers and their cargo back to Chicago. As the Algerians left the ship, they began moving in all directions at once. "I could see them getting lost, being run over, and landing in jail," Bloom said. "No one seemed to be in charge." Bloom raced up to them, shouting commands in French and English. A giant black-complected man walked up to Bloom and, in perfect House of Lords English, said, "I suggest you be more civil. Otherwise I may lose my temper and throw you into the water." The man identified himself as Archie, and as the two settled into a more peaceful conversation, he revealed to Bloom that he had spent a decade in London serving as a rich man's bodyguard. "At present," he said, "I am responsible for conveying my associates to a place called Chicago. I understand it is somewhere in the hinterland." Bloom handed him a cigar and proposed that he become his bodyguard and assistant. "Your offer," Archie said, "is quite satisfactory." Both men lit up and puffed smoke into the fragrant murk above New York Harbor. Bloom wanted to thrill America, but even he did not appreciate the power the Algerians possessed to succeed at the task. Bloom put the members to work. Archie became a powerful and vaguely threatening presence in his office. Several Algerian women also worked there, clad in customary dress and speaking excellent English, while evoking a world of cinnamon and heat that greatly enhanced Bloom's stature as a promotional prodigy. Burnham fought to boost the rate of construction, especially of the manufacturer's building, which had to be completed by dedication day. In March, with just half a year remaining until the dedication, he invoked the Czar clause of his construction contracts. He ordered the builder of the electricity building to double his workforce and to put the men to work at night under electric lights. He threatened the manufacturer's contractor with the same fate if he did not increase the pace of his work. Burnham had all but given up hope of surpassing the Eiffel Tower. Most recently, he had turned down another outlandish idea, this from an earnest young Pittsburgh engineer who had attended his lecture to the Saturday Afternoon Club. The man was credible enough. His company held the contract for inspecting all the steel used in the fair's structures, but the thing he proposed to build just did not seem feasible. "Too fragile," Burnham told him. "The public," he said, "would be afraid." A hostile spring further hampered the fair's progress. On Tuesday, April 5th, 1892, at 6:50 a.m., a sudden windstorm demolished the fair's just-finished pumping station and tore down 65 feet of the Illinois State Building. 3 weeks later, another storm destroyed 800 feet of the south wall of the manufacturer's building. "The wind," the Tribune observed, "seems to have a grudge against the World's Fair grounds." To find ways to accelerate the work, Burnham called the Eastern architects to Chicago. One looming problem was how to color the exteriors of the main buildings, especially the staff-coated palisades of the manufacturer's building. During the meeting, an idea arose that promised a dramatic acceleration of the work. No one could have foretold how this one decision would forever fix the fair in the world's imagination as a thing of otherworldly beauty. By all rights, the arena of exterior decoration belonged to William Prettyman, the fair's official director of color. Burnham admitted later that he had hired Prettyman for the job largely on account of his great friendship for John Root. Prettyman was ill-suited to the job. Harriet Monrose, who knew him and his wife, wrote, "His genius was betrayed by lofty and indomitable traits of character, which could not yield or compromise, and so his life was a tragedy of inconsequence. The day of the meeting, Prettyman was on the East Coast. The architects proceeded without him. "I was urging everyone on, knowing I had an awful fight against time," Burnham said. "We talked about the colors, and finally the thought came, let us make it all perfectly white." I do not remember who made that suggestion. It might have been one of those things that reached all minds at once. At any rate, I decided it. The Mines Building, designed by Chicago's Solon S. Beeman, was nearly finished. It became the test building. Burnham ordered it painted a creamy white. Prettyman returned and was outraged, Burnham recalled. Prettyman insisted that any decision on color was his alone. "I don't see it that way," Burnham told him. "The decision is mine." "All right," Prettyman said. "I will get out." Burnham did not miss him. "He was a brooding sort of man and very cranky," Burnham said. "I let him go, then told Charles McKim that I would have to have a man who could actually take charge of it, and that I would not decide from the point of friendship." McKim recommended the New York painter Francis Millet, who had sat in on the color meeting. A brief period of awkwardness followed over the question of salary. Millet would be delighted to join the fair, a memorandum reported, but regretted extremely that circumstances were such that he must, in a measure, consider the question of compensation. Over dinner in New York at Delmonico's, Burnham agreed to a salary of $15,000, the highest paid to any fair official other than himself. In July, the executive committee formally approved Millet's appointment, but for only half the salary Burnham had offered. By then, however, Millet had fallen for the fair and for Burnham, and would have stayed even if the committee had cut his salary to nothing. Millet quickly proved his worth. After some experimentation, he settled on ordinary white, lead, and oil as the best paint for staff, then developed a means of applying the paint not by brush, but through a hose with a special nozzle fashioned from a length of gas pipe. The first spray paint. Burnham nicknamed Millet and his paint crews the Whitewash Gang. In the first week of May, a powerful storm dropped an ocean of rain on Chicago and again caused the Chicago River to reverse flow. With its baggage of dead animals and human sewage, the river raced into Lake Michigan with such force that tugboats towing steamships had to wait at the river's mouth until the flow subsided. Again, the sewage threatened the city's water supply. The decaying carcass of a horse was spotted bobbing near one of the intake cribs. This new surge underscored for Burnham the urgency of completing his plan to pipe Waukesha spring water to the fair by opening day. Earlier in July 1891, the exposition had granted a contract for the work to the Hygieum Mineral Springs Company, headed by an entrepreneur named J.E. McElroy, but the company had accomplished little. In March, Burnham ordered Dion Geraldine, his chief construction superintendent, to press the matter with the utmost vigor and see that no delay occurs. Hygieia secured rights to lay its pipe from its spring house in Waukesha through the village itself, but failed to anticipate the intensity of opposition from citizens who feared the pipeline would disfigure their landscape and drain their famous springs. Hygieia's McElroy, under mounting pressure from Burnham, turned to desperate measures. On Saturday evening, May 7th, 1892, McElroy loaded a special train with pipes, picks, shovels, and 300 men and set off for Waukesha to dig his pipeline under cover of darkness. Word of the expedition beat the train to Waukesha. As it pulled into the station, someone rang the village fire bell, and soon a large force of men armed with clubs, pistols, and shotguns converged on the train. Two fire engines arrived, hissing steam, their crews ready to blast the pipe layers with water. One village leader told McElroy that if he went ahead with his plan, he would not leave town alive. Soon, another 1,000 or so townspeople joined the small army at the station. One group of men dragged a cannon from town hall and trained it on Hygieia's bottling plant. After a brief standoff, McElroy and the pipelayers went back to Chicago. Burnham still wanted that water. Workers already had laid pipes in Jackson Park for 200 spring water booths. McElroy gave up trying to run pipes directly into the village of Waukesha. Instead, he bought a spring in the town of Big Bend, 12 miles south of Waukesha, just inside the Waukesha County line. Fair visitors would be able to drink Waukesha spring water after all. That the water came from the county and not the famous village was a subtlety upon which Burnham and McElroy did not dwell. In Jackson Park, everyone became caught up in the accelerating pace of construction. As the buildings rose, the architects spotted flaws in their designs, but found the forward crush of work so overwhelming it threatened to leave the flaws locked in stone, or at least staff. Frank Millett unofficially kept watch over the buildings of the Eastern architects during their lengthy absences from the park, lest some ad hoc decision cause irreparable aesthetic damage. On June 6, 1892, he wrote to Charles McKim, designer of the agriculture building, "You had better write a letter embodying all the ideas of changes you have, because before you know it, they'll have you by the umbilicus. I staved them off from a cement floor in the rotunda today and insisted that you must have brick. It takes no end of time and worry to get a thing settled right, but only a second to have orders given out for a wrong thing to be done. All these remarks are in strict confidence, and I write in this way to urge you to be explicit and flat-footed in your wishes." At the manufacturer's building, workers employed by contractor Francis Agnew began the dangerous process of raising the giant iron trusses that would support the building's roof and create the widest span of unobstructed interior space ever attempted. The workers installed 3 sets of parallel railroad tracks along the length of the building. Atop these, on rail car wheels or trucks, they erected a traveler, a giant derrick comprised of 3 tall towers spanned at the top by a platform. Workers using the traveler could lift and position 2 trusses at a time. Henry Post's design called for 22 trusses, each weighing 200 tons. Just getting the components to the park had required 600 rail cars. On Wednesday, June 1st, exposition photographer Charles Arnold took a photograph of the building to record its progress. Anyone looking at that photograph would have to conclude that the building could not possibly be finished in the 4.5 months that remained until dedication day. The trusses were in place, but no roof. The walls were just beginning to rise. When Arnold took the photograph, hundreds of men were at work on the building, but its scale was so great that none of the men was immediately visible. The ladders that rose from one level of scaffold to the next had all the substance of matchsticks and imparted to the structure an aura of fragility. In the foreground stood mountains of debris. 2 weeks later, Arnold returned for another photograph and captured a very different scene. One of devastation. On the night of June 13th, just after 9 o'clock, another abrupt storm struck the fairgrounds, and this one also seemed to single out the manufacturer's building. A large portion of the building's north end collapsed, and in turn caused the failure of an elevated gallery designed to ring the interior of the building. 100,000 feet of lumber crashed to the floor. Arnold's photograph of the aftermath showed a Lilliputian man, possibly Burnham, standing before a great mound of shattered wood and tangled steel. This, of all buildings. The contractor, Francis Agnew, acknowledged the wall had been inadequately braced, but blamed this condition on Burnham for pushing the men to build too quickly. Now Burnham pushed them even harder. He made good on his threat and doubled the number of men working on the building. They worked at night, in rain, in stifling heat. In August alone, the building took 3 lives. Elsewhere on the grounds, 4 other men died, and dozens more suffered all manner of fractures, burns, and lacerations. The fair, according to one later appraisal, was a more dangerous place to work than a coal mine. Burnham intensified his drive for more power. The constant clash between the Exposition Company and the National Commission had become nearly unbearable. Even the congressional investigators had recognized that the overlapping jurisdiction was a source of discord and needless expense. Their report recommended that Davis's salary be cut in half, a clear sign that the balance of power had shifted. The company and commission worked out a truce. On August 24th, the executive committee named Burnham director of works, chief of everything. Soon afterward, Burnham dispatched letters to all his department heads, including Olmsted. I have assumed personal control of the active work within the grounds of the World's Columbian Exposition, he wrote. Henceforward, and until further notice, you will report to and receive orders from me exclusively. In Pittsburgh, the young steel engineer became more convinced than ever that his challenge to the Eiffel Tower could succeed. He asked a partner in his inspection firm, W.F. Granau, to calculate the novel forces that would play among the components of his structure. In engineering parlance, it embodied little dead load, the static weight of immobile masses of brick and steel. Nearly all of it was live load, meaning weight that changes over time, as when a train passes over a bridge. I had no precedent, Granau said. After 3 weeks of intense work, however, he came up with detailed specifications. The numbers were persuasive, even to Burnham. In June, the Ways and Means Committee agreed that the thing should be built. They granted a concession. The next day, the committee revoked it. Second thoughts, after a night spent dreaming of freak winds and shrieking steel, and 2,000 lives gone in a wink. One member of the committee now called it a monstrosity. A chorus of engineers chanted the thing could not be built, at least not with any margin of safety. Its young designer still did not concede defeat, however. He spent $25,000 on drawings and additional specifications and used these to recruit a cadre of investors that included 2 prominent engineers, Robert Hunt, head of a major Chicago firm, and Andrew Onderdonk, famous for helping construct the Canadian Pacific Railway. Soon, he sensed a change. The new man in charge of the Midway, Saul Bloom, had struck like a bolt of lightning and seemed amenable to just about anything. The more novel and startling, the better. And Burnham had gained almost limitless power over the construction and operation of the fair. The engineer readied himself for a third try. In the first week of September 1892, Olmsted and his young party left England for home, departing Liverpool aboard the City of New York. The seas were high, the crossing difficult. Seasickness felled Marion and left Rick perpetually queasy. Olmsted's own health again declined. His insomnia came back. He wrote, "I was more disabled when I returned than when I left." Now, however, he had no time to recuperate. Dedication Day was only a month away, and Harry Codman was again ill, incapacitated by the same stomach problem that had struck him during the summer. Olmsted left for Chicago to take over direct supervision of the work while Codman recovered. "I am still tortured a good deal with neuralgia and toothache," Olmsted wrote, "and I am tired and have a growing dread of worry and anxiety." In Chicago, he found a changed park. The mines building was done, as was the fisheries building. Most of the other buildings were well underway, including, incredibly, the giant manufacturer's building, where hundreds of workers swarmed its scaffolds and roof. The building's floor alone had consumed 5 train car loads of nails. Amid all this work, however, the landscape had suffered. Temporary tracks latticed the grounds. Wagons had gouged chasms across paths, roads, and would-be lawns. Litter lay everywhere. A first-time visitor might wonder if Olmsted's men had done any work at all. Olmsted, of course, knew that tremendous progress had been made, but it was the sort that escaped casual notice. Lagoons existed now where once there had been barren land. The elevated sites upon which the building stood had not existed until his grading teams created them. The previous spring his men had planted nearly everything raised in the exposition's nurseries, plus an additional 200,000 trees, aquatic plants and ferns, and 30,000 more willow cuttings. All this under the direction of his aptly named head gardener, E. Den. In the time left before dedication day, Burnham wanted Olmsted's men to concentrate on cleaning the grounds and dressing them with flowers and temporary lawns of sod, actions that Olmsted understood were necessary, but that clashed with his career-long emphasis on designing for scenic effects that might not be achieved for decades. "Of course, the main work suffers," he wrote. One indisputably positive development had occurred during his absence, however. Burnham had awarded the boat concession to a company called the Electric Launch and Navigation Company, which had produced a lovely electric vessel of exactly the character Olmsted wanted. On dedication day, even the press was polite enough to overlook the stark appearance of the grounds and the unfinished feel of the manufacturer's building. To have done otherwise would have been an act of disloyalty to Chicago and the nation. The dedication had been anticipated nationwide. Francis J. Bellamy, an editor of Youth's Companion, thought it would be a fine thing if on that day all the school children of America, in unison, offered something to their nation. He composed a pledge which the Bureau of Education mailed to virtually every school. It began, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." A great parade brought Burnham and other dignitaries to the manufacturer's building, where a standing army of 140,000 Chicagoans filled the 32-acre floor. Shafts of sunlight struck through the rising mist of human breath. 5,000 yellow chairs stood on the red-carpeted speaker's platform, and in these chairs sat businessmen dressed in black, foreign commissioners and clerics in scarlet, purple, green, and gold. Ex-Mayor Carter Harrison, running now for a 5th term, strode about shaking hands, his black slouch hat raising cheers from supporters in the crowd. At the opposite end of the building was a 5,000-voice choir, which sang Handel's Hallelujah Chorus to the accompaniment of 500 musicians. At one point, a spectator recalled, 90,000 people suddenly rose and stood upon their feet and simultaneously waved and fluttered 90,000 snowy pocket handkerchiefs. The air was cut into dusty spirals which vibrated to the great iron-ribbed ceiling. One had a sense of dizziness, as if the entire building rocked. The chamber was so immense that visual signals had to be used to let the chorus know when a speaker had stopped talking and a new song could begin. Microphones did not yet exist, so only a small portion of the audience actually heard any speeches. The rest, with faces contorted from the strain of trying to listen, saw large, distant men gesturing wildly into the sound-killing miasma of whispers, coughs, and creaking shoe leather. Harriet Monroe, the poet who had been John Root's sister-in-law, was there and watched as two of the nation's greatest speakers, Colonel Henry Watterson of Kentucky and Chauncey M. Depew of New York, took turns at the podium, both orators waving their windy words toward a vast, whispering, rustling audience which could not hear. This was a big day for Miss Monroe. She had composed a lengthy poem for the event, her Columbian ode and pestered her many powerful friends into having it placed on the day's program. She watched with pride as an actress read it to the few thousand people close enough to hear it. Unlike the majority of the audience, Monroe believed the poem to be rather a brilliant work, so much so that she had hired a printer to produce 5,000 copies for sale to the public. She sold few, and attributed the debacle to America's fading love of poetry. That winter, she burned the excess copies for fuel. Prendergast. On November 28, 1892, Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast, the mad Irish immigrant, selected one of his postal cards. He was 24 years old now, and despite his accelerating mental decline, was still employed by the Interocean as a delivery contractor. The card, like all the others, was 4 inches wide by 5 inches long, blank on one face, with postal insignia and a printed 1 cent stamp on the other. In this time when writing long letters was everyday practice, men of normal sensibility saw these cards as the most crabbed of media, little better than telegrams, but to Prendergast, this square of stiff paper was a vehicle that gave him voice in the skyscrapers and mansions of the city. He addressed this particular card to A.S. Trude, lawyer. He sketched the letters of the name in large floral script, as if seeking to dispatch the cumbersome duty of addressing the card as quickly as possible before advancing to the message itself. That Prendergast selected Trude to be one of his correspondents was not surprising. Prendergast read widely and possessed a good grasp of the grip car wrecks, murders, and city hall machinations covered so fervently by the city's newspapers. He knew that Alfred S. Trude was one of Chicago's best criminal defense attorneys, and that from time to time he was hired by the state to serve as prosecutor, a practice customary in particularly important cases. Prendergast filled the postcard from top margin to bottom, from edge to edge, with little regard for whether the sentences formed level lines or not. He gripped the pen so tightly it impressed channels into the tips of his thumb and forefinger. "My dear Mr. Trude," he began, "were you much hurt?" An accident reported in the press had caused Trude minor injuries. "Your humble servant hereby begs leave to tender you his sincere sympathy, and trusts that while he does not appear before you in person, you nonetheless will not have any doubts as to his real sympathy for you in your misfortunes. You are wished by him a speedy recovery from the results of the accident which you had the misfortune to meet with." He wrote with a tone of familiarity that presumed Trude would consider him a peer. As the note progressed, his handwriting shrank until it seemed like something extruded rather than written. "I suppose, Mr. Trude, that you do understand that the greatest authority on the subject of law is Jesus Christ, and that you also know that the fulfillment of the whole law depends upon the observance of these two commands, thou shalt love God most of all, and your neighbor as yourself. These are the greatest commands, if you please, sir." The note clicked from theme to theme like the wheels of a train crossing a freight yard. Have you ever saw the picture of the fat man who looked for his dog while his dog was at his feet and still did not have the wit to see what was the matter? Have you observed the cat? He did not add a closing and did not sign the note. He simply ran out of room, then posted the card. Trude read the note and at first dismissed it as the work of a crank. The number of troubled men and women seemed to be increasing with each passing year. The jails were full of them, a warden later would testify. Inevitably, some became dangerous, like Charles Guiteau, the man who assassinated President Garfield in Washington. For no clear reason, Trude kept the card. "I want you at once." In late November, the young Pittsburgh engineer once again put his proposal for out-Eiffeling Eiffel before the Ways and Means Committee. This time, in addition to drawings and specifications, he included a list of investors, the names of the prominent men on his board, and proof that he had raised enough money to finance the project to completion. On December 16, 1892, the committee granted him a concession to build his structure in the Midway Plaisance. This time, the decision held. He needed an engineer willing to go to Chicago and supervise the construction effort, and thought he knew just the man. Luther V. Rice, assistant engineer of the Union Depot and Tunnel Company, St. Louis. His letter to Rice began, "I have on hand a great project for the World's Fair in Chicago. I am going to build a vertically revolving wheel 250 feet in diameter." Nowhere in this letter, however, did he reveal the true dimension of his vision, that this wheel would carry 36 cars, each the size of a Pullman, each holding 60 people and equipped with its own lunch counter, and how, when filled to capacity, the wheel would propel 2,160 people at a time, 300 feet into the sky over Jackson Park, a bit higher than the crown of the now 6-year-old Statue of Liberty. He told Rice, "I want you at once, if you can come." He signed the letter, George Washington Gale Ferris. Chapel Redux. One day in the first week of December 1892, Emmeline Sigrund set out for Holmes's building in Inglewood bearing a small, neatly wrapped parcel. Initially, her mood was bright, for the parcel contained an early Christmas present she planned to give to her friends, the Lawrences. But as she neared the corner of 63rd and Wallace, her spirits dimmed. Where once the building had seemed almost a palace, not for its architectural nobility, but for what it promised, now it looked drab and worn. She climbed the stairs to the second floor and went directly to the Lawrence's apartment. The warmth and welcome resurrected her good spirits. She handed the parcel to Mrs. Lawrence, who opened it immediately and pulled from the wrapping a tin plate upon which Emmeline had painted a lovely forest. The gift delighted Mrs. Lawrence, but also perplexed her. Christmas was only 3 weeks off, she said, kindly. Why hadn't Emmeline simply waited and given the plate then, when Mrs. Lawrence could have offered a gift in return? Her face brightening, Emmeline explained that she was going home to Indiana to spend Christmas with her family. She seemed delighted with the anticipation of a visit to them, Mrs. Lawrence said. She spoke in most affectionate terms of them and seemed as happy as a child. But Mrs. Lawrence also sensed a note of finality in Emmeline's voice that suggested Emmeline's journey might have another purpose. She said, "You are not going away from us." "Well," Emmeline said, "I don't know. Maybe." Mrs. Lawrence laughed. "Why, Mr. Holmes could never get along without you." Emmeline's expression changed. "He could if he had to." The remark confirmed something for the Lawrences. It had seemed to me for some time that Miss Sigrund was changing in her feelings toward Holmes, said Dr. Lawrence. In the light of what has happened since, I believe now that she had found out, to a certain extent, the real character of Holmes and determined to leave him. She may have begun to believe the stories she heard in the neighborhood of Holmes's penchant for acquiring things on credit and then not paying for them. Stories she had heard all along, for they were rife, but that she at first dismissed as the gossip of envious hearts. Later there was speculation that Emmeline herself had trusted Holmes with her $800 savings, only to have it disappear in a fog of promises and lavish future returns. Ned Connor's warning echoed in her mind. Lately she had begun talking of returning one day to Dwight to resume her work for Dr. Keeley. Emmeline never told the Lawrences goodbye. Her visits simply stopped. That she would leave without a parting word struck Mrs. Lawrence as being very much out of character. She wasn't sure whether to feel wounded or worried. She asked Holmes what he knew about Emmeline's absence. Ordinarily, Holmes looked at Mrs. Lawrence with a directness that was unsettling, but now he avoided her gaze. "Oh, she's gone away to get married," Holmes said, as if nothing could have interested him less. The news shocked Mrs. Lawrence. "I don't see why she didn't mention something to me about getting married." "It was a secret," Holmes explained. Emmeline and her betrothed had revealed their wedding plans only to him. But for Mrs. Lawrence, this explanation only raised more questions. Why would the couple want such privacy? Why had Emmeline said nothing to Mrs. Lawrence when together they had shared so many other confidences? Mrs. Lawrence missed Emmeline and the way her effervescence and physical brightness, her prettiness and sunflower hair, lit the sullen halls of Holmes's building. She remained perplexed and a few days later again asked Holmes about Emmeline. He pulled a square envelope from his pocket. "This will tell you," he said. The envelope contained a wedding announcement. Not engraved, as was customary, merely typeset. This, too, surprised Mrs. Lawrence. Emmeline never would have accepted so mundane a means of communicating news of such magnitude. The announcement read, "Mr. Robert E. Phelps, Miss Emmeline C. Sigrund, married, Wednesday, December 7th, 1892, Chicago." Holmes told Mrs. Lawrence he had received his copy from Emmeline herself. "Some days after going away, she returned for her mail," he explained in his memoir, "and at this time gave me one of her wedding cards, and also two or three others for tenants in the building who were not then in their rooms. And in response to inquiries lately made, I have learned that at least five persons in and about Lafayette, Indiana, received such cards. The postmark and her handwriting upon the envelope in which they were enclosed, showing that she must have sent them herself after leaving my employ." Emmeline's family and friends did receive copies of the announcement through the mail, and indeed these appeared to have been addressed by Emmeline herself. Most likely Holmes forged the envelopes or else duped Emmeline into preparing them by persuading her they would be used for a legitimate purpose, perhaps for Christmas cards. For Mrs. Lawrence, the announcement explained nothing. Emmeline had never mentioned a Robert Phelps, and if Emmeline had come to the building bearing marriage announcements, she surely would have presented one in person. The next day, Mrs. Lawrence stopped Holmes yet again, and this time asked what he knew about Phelps. In the same dismissive manner, Holmes said, "Oh, he is a fellow Miss Sigrund met somewhere. I do not know anything about him except that he is a traveling man." News of Emmeline's marriage reached her hometown newspaper, which reported it on December 8, 1892, in a small, chatty bulletin. The item called Emmeline a lady of refinement who possesses a character that is strong and pure. Her many friends feel that she has exercised good judgment in selecting a husband and will heartily congratulate her. The item offered a few biographical details, among them the fact that Emmeline once had been employed as a stenographer in the county recorder's office. From there, the item continued, she went to Dwight, and from there to Chicago, where she met her fate. Fate being the writer's coy allusion to marriage. In the days that followed, Mrs. Lawrence asked Holmes additional questions about Emmeline, but he responded only in monosyllables. She began to think of Emmeline's departure as a disappearance and recalled that soon after Emmeline's last visit, a curious change in routine had occurred within Holmes's building. The day after Miss Sigrun disappeared, or the day we last saw her, the door of Holmes's office was kept locked and nobody went into it except Holmes and Patrick Quinlan, Mrs. Lawrence said. About 7 o'clock in the evening, Holmes came out of his office and asked two men who were living in the building if they would not help him carry a trunk downstairs. The trunk was new and large, about 4 feet long. Its contents clearly were heavy and made the big trunk difficult to manage. Holmes repeatedly cautioned his helpers to be careful with it. An express wagon arrived and took it away. Mrs. Lawrence later claimed that at this point she became convinced Holmes had killed Emmeline. Yet she and her husband made no effort to move from the building, nor did they go to the police. No one did. Not Mrs. Lawrence, not Mr. and Mrs. Peter Sigrund, not Ned Connor, and not Julia's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Smythe. It was as if no one expected the police would be interested in yet another disappearance, or if they were, that they would be competent enough to conduct an effective investigation. Soon afterward, Emmeline's own trunk filled with her belongings and all the clothing she had brought with her when she left home in 1891 to work for Keeley arrived at a freight depot near her hometown. Her parents at first believed, hoped, she had sent the trunk home because now that she was marrying a wealthy man, she no longer needed such old and worn things. The Sigrunds received no further mail from Emmeline, not even at Christmas. This, said Dr. B.J. Sigrund, Emmeline's second cousin, the Northside dentist, in spite of the fact that she was in the habit of writing to her parents 2 or 3 times a week. Emmeline's parents still did not imagine murder, however. Peter Sigrund said, I had at last come to the belief she must have died in Europe, and her husband either did not know our address or neglected to notify us. The Sigrunds and Lawrences would have found their anxiety intensified many-fold had they known a few other facts. That the name Phelps was an alias that Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pittitzel, had used when he first met Emmeline at the Keeley Institute. That on January 2, 1893, Holmes again had enlisted the help of Charles Chappell, the articulator, and sent him a trunk containing the corpse of a woman, her upper body stripped nearly bare of flesh. That a few weeks later, the LaSalle Medical School of Chicago had taken delivery of a nicely articulated skeleton. And that something peculiar had occurred in the room-sized vault in Holmes's building, a phenomenon that, when finally discovered by police 3 years later, would defy scientific explanation. Somehow, a footprint had become etched into the smooth enameled finish on the inside of the vault door at a point roughly 2 feet above the floor. The toes, the ball, and the heel were so clearly outlined as to leave no doubt that a woman had left the print. The degree of detail mystified the police, as did the print's resilience. They tried rubbing it off by hand, then with a cloth and soap and water, but it remained as clear as ever. No one could explain it with any certainty. The best guess posited that Holmes had lured a woman into the vault, that the woman was shoeless at the time, perhaps nude, and that Holmes had then closed the airtight door to lock her inside. She had left the print in a last, hopeless effort to force the door open. To explain the print's permanence, detectives theorized that Holmes, known to have an avid interest in chemistry, first poured a sheen of acid onto the floor to hasten, by chemical reaction, the consumption of oxygen in the vault. The theory held that Emmeline had stepped in the acid, then placed her feet against the door, thus literally etching the print into the enamel. This revelation, of course, came much later. As of the start of 1893, the year of the fair, no one, including Holmes, had noticed the footprint on the door. The cold-blooded fact. At the start of January 1893, the weather turned cold and